Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to what is in fact the first of what will be a series of lectures in the name of Sir Patrick Gillam. And before I introduce Professor Wu Cummings, I might just like to say a word or two about that series and how it came about. Patrick Gillam, whom I've had the pleasure of knowing for a long time, is an LSE alumnus. He was here in 1953, I think, to 56, Pat. And Pat, in fact, is sitting down there in the fourth row. I won't embarrass him by making him stand up, which he still can do, in spite of having been here 50 years ago. In fact, when I was a financial regulator in my previous job, he and I used to meet far more frequently than we ever wanted. Not, I should say, because of any problems with Standard Chartered, of which he was the chairman, but also because he chaired an insurance company which had certain difficulties which he and I wrestled with over many fraught meetings. However, Patrick retired as chairman of Standard Chartered Bank 18 months ago, approximately, after 10 very successful years chairing Standard Chartered. And in his honour, Standard Chartered did two things: one, to endow a chair at the school, and also a series of lectures. The chair has now been appointed, Professor John Seidel, who's joined us now, and this is the first of the lectures. And the aim is to have a lecture series which will be focused on those parts of the world in which Standard Chartered have a particular interest, and indeed in which John himself has an interest. So we're delighted to recognise that very generous sponsorship by the bank, and particularly also to recognise an extremely distinguished alumnus. And we're most grateful to you, Pat, for having been here in the first place, but also for having helped endow this series of this chair, which is very much what we like to try to attract to the school. And we're extremely grateful to you for that. And for the first of this series, and John Seidel is in charge of orchestrating the series, of course, as part of his duties as the chair, has chosen to invite Meredith Wu Cummings to join us and to speak about North Korea. And we thought it was a particularly interesting moment to be thinking about what is going on in North Korea. I don't need to tell an LSE audience that North Korea is a founder member of George Bush's axis of evil, and of course a country whose nuclear program and whose whole geopolitical positioning raises some of the most taxing questions for the American administration and indeed for the European Union. And we also, of course, know that the population of that country have lived through extremely difficult times, including famine, over recent years. And we couldn't have anyone better to guide us through this delicate territory than Meredith Wu Cummings, who is professor at the University of Michigan, which is one of the leading centers on the study of East Asia in the US. And it's appropriate that she should be with us for a lecture series named after a distinguished banker, as indeed her first book highlighted the role of banks and finance in South Korea's industrial growth, and her subsequent work has looked at the role of national and international financial institutions in the economic development of East Asia. She is a very frequent commentator, consultant, writer on Asian and Korean affairs, has worked with the Asian Development Bank, with the European Union, and others. And her topic tonight is, as you can see, the political ecology of famine in North Korea, Amartya Sen Revisited, and we are all agog to hear what you have to say, Meredith. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening. I'd like to thank Professors Howard Davies and John Seidel for allowing me the opportunity to give the first Sir Patrick Gillam lecture. It is truly an honor to be here at this great institution and to be part of an important lecture series which is designed to address contemporary issues of great relevance for world politics. But ask a scholar to think contemporary, and our instinct is to reach back, and in this case, to speak of an ancient scourge, famine, long signified by the fourth symbol of the black horse of the apocalypse. Famine is an anachronism in a modern world awash in surplus foodstuffs. Lord John Russell, British Prime Minister at the time of the Irish potato famine, once remarked of the famine that it was as if a famine of the 13th century were acting upon a population of the 19th century. And today, I would like to speak of the same 13th century tragedy visiting itself upon the 21st century and on a country that is another anachronism, North Korea, a communist monarchy, a Confucian anachronism, a country which is, I once heard someone say, Stalinist on a good day. This double anachronism, however, of a state-controlled economy that cannot feed its own people and yet seeks the singular weapons that can create their own human scourge serves as a sword of Damocles hanging over peace and democracy in East Asia. Anachronism thus has a curious way of making itself contemporary and relevant. I first became interested in this issue of the North Korean famine, first of all for personal reasons, as I am of the Korean ancestry, but there was something about this scourge that struck me as truly weird. Of course, Monsoon Asia is historically the lands of famine, whether you see India through Kipling's William the Conqueror or China through Pearl Buck's Good Earth. And in our living memory, we saw the Bangladesh famine of 1974, which claimed anywhere between 250,000 lives. But the first weird thing about the famine in North Korea was the extent of it. It was biblical in proportion. The researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, interviewing mostly refugees, claimed that this famine claimed 12% mortality rate, meaning something like 2.5 million excess deaths related to the famine. I thought this was extraordinary. I thought this was clearly the upper limit, the biggest figure I saw. Until last week, I read an article in the Times, New York Times, by David Singer, who rounded up the figure and said the death figure was something like 3 million, give or take 1 million. And I also read in a book on the North Korean famine by Andrew Natsio, who is the head of USAID, that the figure was also something like 2 million people. Now, let us compare this upper limit figure with the upper limits for other disasters, famine disaster. If you look at the Great Leap Famine in China between 1958 to 1961, American demographers have claimed that the excess figure was something like 30 million people. The Chinese government say 15 million. If you take the 30 million figure, and if you think that the Chinese population around 1958 was maybe about 600 million people, you're still talking 5%. If you take the Great Bengal Famine of 1943, that possibly claimed at the highest rank something like 3 million deaths, that still doesn't give you two digits. So that's the first weird thing I noticed about how the famine was reported. The second weird thing I noticed about this famine is that this famine wasn't supposed to happen. In the context of the Western world, our historical understanding of famine is such that we think of famine as something that happens in colonial times, Irish potato famine, for instance. Or we think of famine as occurring in times of war and revolution. Think Paris Commune, Germany, in World War One, siege of Stalingrad, the odd case of Dutch hunger between 1945 and 1944-45, and the famine in Greece in the early 1940s. Or we think of famine as something that occurs during socialist collectivization, the best example being Stalin's collectivization scheme and the ensuing famine in Ukraine and elsewhere, which combined bad central planning with failed or violent agricultural reforms, and on top of it, ethnic cleansing to finish it all off. That is, famine with truly malicious intent. One might say roughly the same thing about famines in Asia. So there are famines that occur under colonialism. In Japanese-occupied North Vietnam or Tonkin in 1944-1945, there was a famine that claimed anywhere between 500,000 to 2 million lives. The United States also is culpable, as it is said that it induced famine in the Philippines in the year 1900 with systemic destruction of rice stores and livestock to deny food supplies to the hook. And then one talks a lot about the maladministration of the British in India throughout its colonial history, with examples like the 1877 famine in the Indian Deccan and the aforementioned Great Bengal Famine of 1943. Or in Asia, we think about famine in the context of war also. Cambodia in 1979, amid fear that 3 million lives might perish, Rosalind Carter, if you recall, flew over to the Thai-Cambodia border, and she hugged his emaciated children, which opened the floodgate of aid flowing into that country. And of course, there were famines associated with socialist collectivization. There was famine in Mongolia in 1930 and 31 as the result of a Soviet decree for permanent settlement of nomads. Famine in Vietnam in 1954, which claimed upwards of 1 million people dying of starvation. And of course, the biggest enchilada of them all was the one in China between 1958 to 1962, and of course, ensuing famine in Tibet at the same time in 1962. So when you think about this and how famines occur in Asia and in the West, North Korea is an anomaly. That famine should never have happened. Number one, when the famine occurred between 1995 to, let's say, 1998, and there is continuing food shortage in the country, North Korea was not occupied or colonized. This happened 50 years after decolonialization. North Korea wasn't fighting anybody. It wasn't in a war situation. This happened more than 40 years after the Korean War. They weren't going through collectivization. This happened 40 years after collectivization. Not only that, this country had food security. There was never plenty, since North Korea doesn't have land that's hospitable for growing food, but food security more or less worked. They had public distribution system that also more or less worked and was highly egalitarian. And it did a okay job feeding the country, which was highly urban and industrial, if not industrialized. So North Korean famine is a great anomaly. It's an empirical puzzle. And I would argue in the rest of the talk, a theoretical puzzle in light of what we know about famine or about the theories of famine. So today, my purpose is twofold. One, I want to make sense with you of the most famous famine of the 1990s that was constantly shown on TV, and as the result of a great deal of work by aid and relief agencies, we now have a great deal of data on this famine, but which has generated relatively little scholarship. My second purpose is to use it to revise our understanding about how famines occur and about the terribly important problem of famine and poverty. See what the North Korean instance, what kind of light it throws on this intractable problem. So What is our thinking today about famine? I think that the best scholarship is represented by the scholarship of Professor Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winner. The Nobel Prize came partly on the strength of his work on famine and his human entitlement approach, often called the best theory since Malthus. His theory is comprehensive as it transfers political, economic, social, and ethical realm. It is sensible in its public policy component regarding famine relief. Above all, it is influential. And what I want to do is I want to quickly flag your attention to four main aspects of his theory or his argument that's relevant for our understanding or discussion today. What it tells us and does not tell us about the famine in North Korea and the myriad ways in which North Korea might revise our understanding in return. The first argument that I want to talk about is his famous argument about democracy and famine. The argument basically is that democracies don't have famines. Now, let's do a little bit of sociology of knowledge. Professor Sen came up with the idea about how democracies don't have famines by looking at the case of India and China. If you compare the two countries and their developmental record, China wiped the floor with India in terms of growth, social safety net, health, nutrition, longer life expectancy, and lower child mortality. China was doing much better than India. And so Professor Sen was looking at this, and he said, well, all of that is true, but the Chinese have skeletons in their closet, owing to their political structure, owing to their communist authoritarian political structure as versus India's democratic structure. You see, this was in the early 1980s. And in the early 1980s, there were a lot of American demographers who were doing work and coming up with new evidence that during the Great Leap Forward collectivization scheme experience, the famine that ensued ended up claiming something like 30 million lives, which led China scholars beating their breast about how they should have spoken out more loudly when this happened. And then Professor Sen said, well, when you look at figures like this, it's really stunning, he said. Now, India has a terrible problem dealing with poverty and starvation, but what India has everyday mini-Holocaust, not this huge Holocaust that happens under communist dictatorship. And why India has everyday mini-Holocaust rather than a maximum huge Holocaust like what China suffered is because of the existence of open journalism and adversarial politics. In other words, democracy. You know, when you have open journalism, free press, and opposing political parties, you can't really have massive famines occur in your country. And that has become the occasion for the birth of what we might call the iron law of famine studies. Democracies don't have famine. You know, in security studies, we have an iron law called democracies don't fight each other. So this is kind of development studies equivalent of this iron law. Now, to anticipate my argument, what I'll argue throughout this talk is that I don't believe that there is a simple correlation between famine and political regime type. Rather than political regime type, I think what we need to really put a lot of emphasis on is the political processes that immobilize attempts to alleviate problems of food shortage. In other words, not regime type, but political process should be the focus of our understanding. The second argument that Professor Sen has is an argument against something called food availability decline. He has argued that total food supply isn't really the major culprit in times of famine. Now, This argument that total food supply isn't really the cause of famine is not really new, in the sense that the Famine Commission of 1880 investigating the famine in India came up with the same conclusion. But the timing of Professor Sen's emphasis on this was brilliant. This was against the backdrop of famines occurring in Africa in places like Ethiopia and Somalia in the 70s and 80s. Once again, to anticipate my argument, I think he might have overstated his case, in part because he was looking too hard on the Indian case. In highly stratified societies and in market societies, I think he's right that total food availability is probably not a very serious problem. Food can be abundant in the midst of misery and starvation. Food can be hoarded and exported out of the country, even as people starve. But here's a rub. If Professor Sen is correct, if famines occur in non-democratic, closed totalitarian societies that are also relatively egalitarian, does it not stand to reason then that absolute food availability and supply is a problem? And if I'm right, I think we need to search for reasons why there is absolute shortage of food, and not on the problem merely of entitlement and access to food. In other words, we need to pay a lot more attention to developmental catastrophes that occur in totalitarian societies. The third aspect I'll be highlighting is entitlement theory, which is by and large definitional. He argues that famine is a catastrophic loss of entitlement to acquiring food through either production possibilities or trade or entitlement vis-a-vis the state. Entitlement protection in Professor Sen's scheme becomes critically important. And what he gives us here is a definition, as I said, of famine, catastrophic loss of entitlement, and less a theory of how famines occur in non-democratic societies. I think we really need to pay more attention to how catastrophic system breakdown occurs, a developmental angle. Finally, I'll be talking about social consequences of famine. Now, Professor Sen doesn't discuss this in his work, in his many important works on famine. But famines have huge social consequences. This was true of Greco-Roman times, as it is true today in North Korea as well. Famine is a historical marker. For people, don't forget hunger. Famine and hunger is how people in primitive societies remember history. They remember the years when they're hungry or when their parents are hungry. Now, before I go into details, I just wanted to say that I have great respect for Amartya Sen's work, but I think that the best way to show this respect is to treat his work with utmost seriousness. So let me go back and revisit the four main issues that I flagged before you one by one with a long glance at North Korea. Number one, the argument about political regime type, free press, adversarial politics, etc. Professor Sen uses the case of African democracies and how well they actually protect entitlement regime. He uses countries like Cape Verde, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and how they were able to avoid famine through entitlement protection systems such as early warning, early response, food supply management, private trade, and public distribution. Which is true. But just what constitutes a functioning multi-party democracy in the developing world is not an easy question. Well, Botswana has always been the shining example of democracy in Africa. It is democratic. It has a relatively efficient administration, although one would be hard-pressed to call it multi-party democracy, because it's had one dominant political party for decades. And then Zimbabwe of Robert Mugabe, or Kenya, Cape Verde, well, it's sometimes hard to see why some countries qualify as democracies and some not. Not only that, there are some interesting cases of so-called democracies. That is Sudan under the government of Sadiq el-Mahdi, the so-called democratic government of Sadiq el-Mahdi, that induced famine in that country. And so I think that these are really borderline cases, perhaps, that we're talking about. But on the other hand, I would say that the very general idea of Professor Sen's, that democratic and open societies are better able to avoid famine, that's common sense enough. I mean, I don't think anybody argues with that. But to elevate it to the level of an iron law, I think, is a problem. Now, let's look at North Korea. On the face of it, North Korea is a really perfect example of the linkage between the absence of democracy and famine. But upon close scrutiny, we realize that the picture might be murkier. I think it's quite possible that with the North Korean famine, information per se was not a problem. The world knew that in the early 1990s, there was a food problem in North Korea. North Koreans asked for help from South Korea and Japan, as well as China. By 1992, the North Koreans are conducting a campaign, national campaign, called Let's Eat Two Meals a Day. And it's not because they were fat. The question is, what did the free people do with the information? The cessation of concessionary food aid from the Soviet Union stopped in 1991. By 1993, the Chinese were demanding cash payment for food imports from the North Koreans. South Korea refused to help, hoping that maybe if you tighten the loose, then North Korea might collapse. Now, the North Korean inability or lack of desire to really deal expeditiously with the food problem borders on criminal on the part of the North Korean regime, but I think that one might also say that it is callousness on the part of the rest of the world to let this unfold. But if you look at it that way, you see, even in the Great Leap Forward famine, in 1958, information wasn't really the main problem. 1958 was a bumper year in many parts of China, but Mao Zedong knew, even as early as 1958, that there were parts in China which had food problems and that people were starving. And, you know, by 1959, when the problem got to be really serious, Mao was apprised of the situation. The problem was political immobilism, which was caused by political struggle, power struggle, that Mao Zedong was engaged in with Peng Duhuai at the Lushan Plenum. With regard to North Korea, one might say that absence of democracy and adversarial politics were the sins of that regime, but these sins are 50 years old. And in those 50 years, they were always able to protect their entitlement regime. But the famine ended up being a very recent problem. Well, Kim Il-sung, the founding father of North Korea, died in 1994, and there was a terrible political immobilism that ensued for the next 3 years as the country mourned the death of Kim Il-sung, and Kim Jong-un refused to take over the helm of the state. And we don't really know what happened, but it'll be safe to say that there was a great power struggle going on in that country, which immobilized the political system. And so I think that understanding the nature of political immobilization is the proper focus of in trying to understand why the problem was not alleviated. Now, let's go back to the issue of food availability decline thesis. Once you posit that total food supply or food availability decline might be a big part of famine, the one first candidate you think about is the climate, and about how natural calamities conspire with social calamities of terrible political system to produce a disaster like famine. Raymond Williams once said, "Nature contains, though often unnoticed, an extraordinary amount of human history." I might say that the reverse is also true. History contains, though often unnoticed, an extraordinary amount of nature. And I think that it's very important that we work through this very complex ecology, this very complex interaction between the climate and the political system. Mike Davis, the maverick American thinker who's written a great deal about urban decay, has written a book which came out a few years ago called The Victorian Holocaust, which contains a very suggestive thesis between connecting world climate system and the world economy. He said that there was a very bad case of El Nino incident in the late 1870s, which caused famine all throughout the world, and especially that world we have now come to call the Third World. This is India, Ceylon, North China, Southern Java and Borneo, the Visayas, Egypt, Algeria, Morocco, Angola, South Africa, Northeast Brazil, all at once. Well, that's a really interesting thesis, very suggestive, and so I began tracking what this El Nino and El Nino Southern Oscillation business might have done to North Korean agriculture. And as you see, Northern China and North Korea is part of the warm episode of the El Nino. Now, it turns out that in 1996, which is when the famine began, the DPRK, that's North Korea Bureau of Hydrometeorological Service, recorded, quote, worst floods in a century, unquote, end of quote. These epic floods were followed by, quote, worst drought in decades, end of quote, wiping out 70% of its vital maize crop. This is according to FAO and World Food Program Mission Report of July 1997. If you look at the agricultural land damaged by floods in 1995-1996 in North Korea, this is the North Korean figure, actually, and probably greatly exaggerated, but still it shows that the damage was extensive in 95-96. Now, in 97, these floods were followed by a drought. You see the average rainfall and what happened in 1997, and the United States was tracking all this actually, as you can see in the satellite image of the impact of drought in North Korea. This is a satellite image collected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So after three catastrophic years of floods and droughts, between 1998 and 1999, North Korea had relatively ordinary droughts, and then again in year 2000, all hell broke loose. There was a drought in year 2000, which also affected China and a number of other countries in Central and North South Asia, as well as the Middle East. But the impact was the greatest on North Korea, since it can produce food only one season, from June to October. The FAO and World Food Program representatives reported empty reservoirs with overall water situation extremely poor. Following this drought, North Korea had the coldest winter in decades. And DPRK was once again hit by prolonged severe drought in the spring of 2001, which ravaged their winter-spring wheat, barley, and potato crops, once again according to the mission report. When you look at figures like this, you think something is wrong here. And I would say that North Korea was in the eye of the ecological disaster, global ecological disaster known as ENSO, El Niño Southern Oscillation, at least from 1997 on. El Niño, as you know, is the weak countercurrent that slightly raises sea temperatures off the coast of Ecuador and Peru every year near Christmas time, which is how you get the name El Niño, the Christ child. ENSO, the Southern Oscillation, is the active ocean component of a vast Pacific basin-wide oscillation in air mass and ocean temperature, and particularly the warm phase of ENSO, which, as you saw in the map, which I showed you before. Now, according to meteorologists, the record of ENSO, the Southern Oscillation, goes back to 1728. And in the nearly 300 years of its recorded history, there were three truly big El Niño Southern Oscillations. In 1876, which is the Victorian Holocaust that Mike Davis talks about, which affected India, China, and Brazil, the second biggest in recorded history was in 1982, which produced a famine in many parts of Africa, and which also produced the famine theories of Professor Sen. And then the third greatest episode of El Niño Southern Oscillation was in 1997-1998, in the depth of the North Korean Holocaust, which marked the year the worst drought in decades, according to the North Koreans. The 1997-1998 ENSO had a very long reach, stretching from Syria to Mongolia to China and also to Southeast Asia, devastating several developing economies that were mostly hapless against the most unusual climatic aberrations. A particularly severe winter in Tibet wiped out an estimated 20% of all its livestock. In Mongolia, it produced a summer drought that left the animals unable to fatten for winter and eventually killed some 3 million livestock. In Indonesia, an extended El Niño-associated drought aided the devastating fire that ripped through its tinder-dry forest, causing an estimated forest damage of 17,000 square miles. In Tajikistan, famine threatened its 6 million people in what was deemed the worst drought in half century. So ENSO, I think, played havoc in 1997 in North Korea following the floods in 1995-1996. There isn't a whole lot written about it, except I did read a report done by the U.S. Army Topographical Engineering Center, which was the first report that noted that ENSO was causing tremendous agricultural damage in North Korea. Now, all of this is quite interesting. The military, obviously, is very interested in the weather pattern, and especially in North Korea, because U.S. military superiority is based largely on electronic umbrella backed up with a ground presence of mobile infantry and mechanized heavy weapons. Both are advantages, however, that can be wiped out overnight in a 24-hour period that can produce something like 20-inch rainfall. And in North Korea, in 1995, in July, in 24-hour periods, there were rains producing close to 25 inches of rainfall. And actually, I might say as a side here, that North Korea, it was noted by the army people, is the only country with a truly systematic effort to eradicate any external knowledge of its weather or climate data. They take this importance of weather data as a strategic weapon, and they guard it with life. Now, Chinese also have a very extensive record linking the problem in North Korea with ENSO. But actually, once you begin thinking about climatic factors and famine, maybe not as a determinant, but as some kind of contributing figure, a factor that contributes to decline in total food supply, one actually thinks that, in fact, even during the Great Leap Forward famine, the weather played havoc, that there was an El Nino of 1957 to 1959, which created a lot of problem in China, but also produced nearly a million refugees in Brazil. And Chinese meteorologists have characterized the drought in the midst of the Great Leap Famine, which affected one-third of the nation's cultivated acreage, as the most extreme of the 20th century in China. For the first time in human history, they said, people could actually walk across the Yellow River. So here's the irony. Here's North Korea trying so hard to escape the world market system, only to end up getting enmeshed smack in the middle of the world ecological disaster. And what was the upshot here? Estimates of North Korean grain production. If you look at the top line, that's the North Korean official estimate of how much they were producing prior to the famine year 1995. And North Koreans are probably exaggerating how much they were producing in order to show that actually what happened in 1995 was really the weather and not anything else. That's their propaganda line. But that shows there's a precipitous decline, 1994, 1995, 1996. But even if you take the most conservative estimate, which is the estimate by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, shows that there was a decline after 1990 and becoming serious enough, because all it needs in food-scarce country is a few percentage of drop in food supply to cause massive misery. So let us now then move to the developmental context of how the agricultural regime might have imploded so miserably as to cause famine by 1995. Going once again back to Professor Sen, Professor Sen sees famine as something that occurs at the end of a long poverty spectrum. And because we don't want people to die of starvation, it becomes really important that we try to prevent this thing from happening at the end of a long poverty spectrum. And we want to nip it through good operation of private market stimulated by cash support. But what if famine is caused by cataclysmic system breakdown, industrial and agricultural system breakdown, and not as something which is at the end of a long poverty spectrum? Then how do we begin to think about it in a sensible way? Well, the best way to understand or to see what system breakdown might look like in North Korea is to look at this picture. Satellite image of North Korea at night. The lights got turned off. What does it mean? Well, I'll explain this, but they had an agricultural system which was really bizarre. It was truly energy intensive. North Korean system was a very interesting system where agriculture industry was completely concatenated, tied together through a curious energy regime. Now, I'm sort of running ahead of my story here. But there are a lot of economists, especially in Washington, in conservative think tanks, who have said that famine in North Korea is caused by the lack of incentive system in that country. Well, but of course that was true 40 years ago, as it is now, or as it was in 1995. So the simple lack of incentive system couldn't be what caused the famine. In fact, if you look at North Korea, they had a much more decentralized agricultural system than one found in China or in the Soviet Union. The farmers were more to land and home and attached to the tools, agricultural tools they used. And the work team was much smaller in North Korea than it was in China or in the Soviet Union. And between the collectivization in North Korea and 1988, agricultural output in North Korea increased twofold. So it couldn't be that incentive system or the lack of it was ipso facto the cause of famine. I think that the cause has to be found in this peculiar industrial and agricultural system that tied energy regime with industrial regime and agricultural regime, and which produced arguably one of the most energy-dependent agriculture in Asia. And this system imploded when Soviet Union collapsed and refused to give, and overnight concessionary energy imports came to a creaking halt. Imports from USSR, Russia, dropped precipitously in 1991. There's the trade shock. What about energy? If you look at crude oil imports to North Korea, you see that the Russian imports evaporated, and the Chinese, Chinese began demanding cash payment from 1993, and when the North Koreans couldn't pay, its oil imports, exports to North Korea more or less evaporated by 1994. And only when famine became a huge problem, and the Chinese recognized very clearly the famine was related to energy, that they begin giving oil to North Korea again. So why is oil so important for North Korean agriculture? Well, if you look at fertilizer use, and of course to produce fertilizer, you need energy. If you look at North Korean use of fertilizers in 1990, which is in the red there, North Koreans were using as much fertilizer as the South Koreans, and I think South Koreans and Japanese are the heaviest users of fertilizer in the world. They're using a lot more fertilizer than the Chinese, the North Koreans, and certainly much more than the Vietnamese. In part because, as I mentioned before, North Korean land is pretty barren. It's not really hospitable to growing crops. So you have very heavy fertilizer use. And then there was a drop in fertilizer consumption between 1998 to 2004. You can see what kind of impact it might have had on agriculture. But North Korean agriculture is weird that in that it not only used a lot of fertilizer, but made heavy use of tractors. You know, normally, if you have an agriculture where land is abundant, you use a lot of tractors. If land is scarce, you use a lot of fertilizer. Well, in the case of North Korea, they did both. So if you look at tractor and fertilizer applications using 1988 as 100, you see that in the 90s, with the trade shock, there was a precipitous decline in the use of both tractors and fertilizer. So there you already see that there's a really big problem. And then you add a third element, which is irrigation. Irrigation uses a lot of energy. Running water pumps uses a lot of energy. Now, the North Koreans were really gung-ho on irrigation and on terracing the mountains, once again because their land is not hospitable to growing food. And they always thought that showing great terraced mountains to people was show of their great level of industrial and agricultural development. And so if you look at how much electricity was used for water pumps and others for irrigation, I couldn't find a really good graph, but this gives you some idea. If you look at the pink one, the middle column there, it says that about one quarter of online generating capacity, the middle one, is what you need for irrigation in peak seasons. Now, so they were irrigating very much the land, which really shouldn't have been used for agriculture. Now, North Korea had, they were very proud of the farmlands they created through scientific engineering. And here you see terraced hills. Everything was terraced to the hilt. But when you see those terraced hills, you begin to worry, because what it means is soil erosion. Soil erosion by gradient, you see that there was a lot of problem with this terraced mountains. And when you combine the fact that there was no longer any really much of energy imports coming in the early 90s, and irrigation no longer could be done, and then you had ecological degradation that predictably follows any kind of virgin land scheme, drought follows the plow, you know that there is a big problem. Not only that, by the time the floods hit in 1995, 1996, what it did was it wiped out coal mines and wiped out hydroelectric power. And when something like that happens, when you have a Holocaust, which is caused in large part by implosion of the energy regime, what do? You go up to the mountains, chop down trees. When there's no energy consumption, then the biomass consumption goes up. And what does that mean? The mountains get deforested. You see denuded mountains in North Korea, which means that to deal with the food problem, you need to rehabilitate rural energy regime. And in the end, it may be cheaper to aid the country to rehabilitate its rural energy regime than to give them a couple million tons of grains a year, not to mention millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. Here you have North Korean food imports and aid, and today North Korea food imports is down. Much of the shortfall in total food needs and what they can produce domestically is now taken care of through aid. You know, I've heard a lot of people ask me, why would you want to bother? I mean, you have a criminal regime in that country. They can't feed its people. What ought to happen is for that regime to collapse, and not for us to begin talking about aiding the rural energy rehabilitation. On the other hand, I'm reminded by the fact that no communist country ever collapsed as the result of famine. And all it does is to create tremendous sufferings for the people. Now, let's move to the last part of this talk, which is the social consequences of famine. Economists generally have very little to say about the social consequences of famine other than note the obvious, which is that human capital, there's a negative impact on human capital for a very long time. And of course, political scientists don't do much better. I mean, we're interested in things like the relationship between famine and collective action, what happens when people are deprived of food, et cetera, et cetera. We have the famous Minnesota study. Or during the Vietnam War, there was a lot of study on the relations between rebellion and famine. But I think famine's important for other reasons as well. Cornelius Walford once remarked about British famines that British famines produced great social institutions like the English Poor Law, the Corn Laws, and he might have added Famine Code of 1880. And there were great social consequences to the Great Leap Famine. and to the famine in Vietnam and Mongolia. The result of the Great Leap Famine was that Chinese leadership decided never to destroy, in essence, the rural household responsibility system. The household orientation system in China started with the shock of the Great Leap Forward. And research in some areas showed that where the famine was most severe, return to household-centered farming was quicker. And American political scientist, Dao Liang, in his book on the Chinese famine, has argued that the reason why rural sector took off in China with great alacrity after 1978 was because the rural household system was in effect preserved as the result of the Great Famine, of the Great Leap Forward. One might say the same thing about Vietnam. Because of the famine in Vietnam, in northern Vietnam, the Vietnamese never went really too far with collectivization. They reversed their policy after the failure of their collectivization. In North Korea, something similar is happening. As a result of the famine, for better or worse, North Korea has become a transition economy. It is in transition. It has accepted, by default, the expansion of what's sometimes called farmers' markets and other times simply called markets. There are these markets, private markets, that are trading in a wide range of goods and services, and these markets are now providing something like 70 to 80% of the consumption of the urban population. And urban population in North Korea is large because it's an urban country. Something like 60% of population happens to be urban. And this was not through planning. The fact that North Korea is going through this default transition was because their public distribution system basically broke down, and basically because they could not feed their own people. Government threw its hands, and prices are now set by the market. And it is important to remember that even in the days of perestroika, Gorbachev never allowed the market to set the price of goods. What seems to be going on in North Korea as the result of the famine is that there are two types of socialist reforms, if you want to call them reforms, going on all at once in North Korea. One is reminiscent of the not very successful Kosygin reforms in the 1960s. That's the first generation Soviet-style reform, which focuses on better incentives within the old system, basically by changing agricultural procurement prices to make it more attractive for farmers to sell grains to the state. But in addition to this first-generation Soviet-style reform, the North Koreans immediately also moved to second-generation reforms, which involves elements of market socialism and reliance on the private markets, like the one that you see on the PowerPoint. And they did a kind of do-it-yourself double reform, and what ensued as the result of it was two huge devaluations in 2002 and 2003 to catch up with the black market exchange rate. And what it did was to create wild price increases up to 60,000%. The Swedish economist who examined socialist economies said that what occurred in North Korea was very reminiscent of what occurred in the Soviet Union in 1990 when Mikhail Gorbachev's regime entered its death throes. It suggests not only massive distortions but also an absence of careful macroeconomic thinking, which he said was also characteristic of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, it seems it is quite possible that there is no turning back from this. I think that North Korea is, in its own way, becoming a transition economy. So let me conclude. Let me sum up by asking what the Chinese have always asked. they had a pithy way of pondering about famine. Is it bad climate or bad system? Well, clearly bad system. But climate doesn't help, nor does bad economic policy. When you tot all these things up, all these factors that could, in very complicated ways, contribute to famine, to create a complex political ecology of famine, you end up, I think, with a situation that R.H. Tawney once described for the Chinese peasants. When food is scarce in general to start out with, any ripple in the water, when you're standing up to your nose in water, any ripple in the water, even a slight change, can drown you. And I think that what occurred in North Korea was slight or massive, I don't care, change in total food supply enough to cause tremendous misery for the people. Now, unfortunately, the kind of argument of Professor Sen makes people think that you can only solve famine through democracy, through some kind of transition away from totalitarian dictatorship, and I wish very much that this would happen, this transition away from totalitarian dictatorship. But at the same time, it would be wrong to think that more pressure from outside would do good, because it suggests to North Korean leaders the ultimate catastrophe, losing their power and their state. As North Korea threatens today to make good on its claim to possess a nuclear arsenal by testing the bomb, the world finds itself playing with an extraordinarily short hand, such that one option favored by Washington is to sequester this already sequestered nation and to sanction this nation already suffering from terrible shortages of food and fuel, all in the hope of forcing the North Koreans to do what? They have been pressured by the greatest power in the world for 60 years, and what good will more pressure do? I don't really see what can be accomplished through sanction and embargo. The regime will simply pass on the cost to the North Korean people, as it showed it could do in the late 1990s in a criminal way. But I've argued that in odd ways there was a curious silver lining in the famine catastrophe, as famine produced and pushed reform. And I think that so long as we can have greater openness in North Korea through investment and trade, and so long as this trend is irreversible, this might be the better and quicker way to achieve the aim that we all want to achieve, to bring North Korea out to the Committee of Nations in the world. And I think that if it is correct that famine had the social consequence of making North Korea transit, then I think there's a good deal of thinking to do on our part as to how to shepherd this process of economic transitions that began with the famine. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that fascinating expose. And I think I can say, without fear of contradiction, that it's the only lecture we've ever had at the LSE about North Korean famine which has quoted Tawney, Raymond Williams, Lord John Russell, and Rudyard Kipling. But that may not be a huge claim. We have time for some questions. And in order to encourage you, there is also a drink afterwards. But after that talk about famine, I hope not lavish food. However, we will take some questions first. Robert Wade.
I want to ask you a question that's only obliquely related to what you've just been talking about, which was indeed very fascinating. I have long been puzzled, having studied and lived in South Korea, I've long been puzzled as to why it is that the South Koreans seem to have been so unable to penetrate the North Korean regime to get good intelligence about how it was operating from the inside, in something like the way that the East Germans were well able to penetrate the West German regime. I'm simply puzzled as to why, despite great efforts to do so, and despite all the homogeneity of the people, they seem to have been quite unable to do so. So I wondered whether you had any explanation for this apparent complete failure on the South Koreans' part. Normally, the South Koreans fail at almost nothing. But in this context, they failed almost completely.
You know, of course, this is a great mystery, not only for South Koreans, but also for the United States. North Korea is the most impossible country to penetrate for the United States intelligence. And, you know, this has been reported also in the very recently published report on intelligence on Iran nuclear issues, and as well as on North Korea. And I guess one way to think about it maybe is to think about why there is $40 million prize on the head of Osama bin Laden, and yet we can't get him. It's because you can't penetrate the rings around him. There are loyal followers, which make it very difficult to gather intelligence on him. You have we have a system in North Korea, which is very tough, which is very well organized, and which, when you think about it, it gives you pause about the willingness on the part of the United States government to speak cavalierly about forcing regime change. If it is so very difficult to collect intelligence and information on that country, even using spies that speak the same language and whatnot, what makes us to think that regime change would be easy to obtain?
Yeah. Just wait for the microphone. It's just next to you.
May I ask Professor Cummings, are there any reliable figures as to the damage done to children in North Korea, physically and psychologically, as a consequence of the famine? And as a secondary question, what does she feel in her personal estimation of the long-term prospects for such children? And I would like to say thank you for a very, very interesting lecture.
Thank you very much. Well, I don't know if we have reliable data. There's great amount of data now coming out of North Korea, primarily through the work of aid and relief agency people, on the stunted growth and of children in North Korea, based on analysis of required caloric intake and whatnot, and also by interviewing and looking at refugee children. So I think there's really quite a bit you can get on the internet as well. What the prospect for these children are, you know, it would be the same as in other countries, other places where people suffer from malnutrition and struck by disasters like famine. I've always heard it said that the North Korean children are much shorter than South Korean children at same age level.
Yeah. Could I ask you to give your name as you ask a question? Thank you.
My name is Mu. I'm a Chinese visiting fellow at Asia Research Center, LSE. You talk so much about climate change, nature disaster, lack of oil or energy in there. I don't think these are the main reason for famine in North Korea. I think the main reason is the wrong policy. They make a mistake in policy. That is to say, the regime, the North Korean regime, put so much money on the national defense or the nuclear weapons. They can ask people, let's have two meals every day, but they cannot say, let's have two meals for soldiers. They cannot say, let's soldiers have two meals every day. why they changed the policy, they put so much attention on the military construction, just because after Cold War, the international community, the international situation, the outside surrounding is changed. So nowhere can guarantee United States or some other countries will invade North Korea, just like they did to the Iraq. So in the Cold War time, China or Russia in some way can guarantee, or you know, North Korea have some advantage in the triangle relations between Russia, China, and the United States. But now, Soviet Union collapse. China has more pro-capitalism policy. So the only way for North Korea that is help themselves try to build military construction. If they haven't nuclear weapons, just like what happened in Iraq, just because Iraq haven't weapons of mass destruction, so America can invade him, occupy him. So if North Korea, so that's why North Korea put so much money on attention, energy, on the military. So that's why they cannot have sufficient money, energy, oil for the agriculture, for the food supply. So what do you think of this? Thank you.
I agree with you completely. The major cause of this famine is really bad policy, really bad political system. Their obsessive interest in militarizing society, obsessive interest in building strong military that can withstand any kind of attack. North Korea maintaining the garrison state is really a very big reason. At the same time, I wanted to underscore the fact that famine is a very complex phenomena to understand, that it is probably not very useful to try to figure out what might be the single most important cause and whatnot, that one needs to pay attention to number of different factors. And if total food supply is important, then let's pay some attention to the climate, as one used to pay attention to climate in the past, although not in modern times, because it boggles one's mind that people could starve amid so much food in the world today. So that was all I was trying to say. And in certain ways, I suppose I underemphasized the military aspect of it, because in some sense, to me, it seemed a little bit self-evident that you have this country which is armed to the teeth, which is paranoid, which is in a continuous state of war in its mind.
Could I ask a question which is perhaps slightly speculative, but thinking about the factors in the environment and really picking up your point about the policy roots of this, it seems to me this could quite well happen again if nothing else changed in the environment. I mean, there could well be another situation of El Nino, there could well be another problem. In those circumstances, and thinking about the tentative détente between the two Koreas that we have seen since, that's the one thing, I guess, that has changed since the last time over the last decade. Do you think that the South Korean policy response, if this situation were to recur, would be the same, i.e. sit back, not help in the hope that this will bring the regime down, or would South Korea take a different approach next time?
Well, South Korea would take a very different approach than it took in the early 1990s, when not only the South Korean government, but probably the Chinese government, probably, I think, figured that North Korea would collapse, which is the only way I can understand why the Chinese refused to bail out the North Koreans in the early 90s, knowing the difficulties that the North Koreans had. Ever since the historic election of President Kim Dae-jung and his announcement that South Korea renounces its effort to, as in the past, force overnight collapse of North Korea, that I think was a historical turn, and that I don't think that they would, even with change of regime in South Korea later on, change that basic policy of not forcing through all any means the collapse of North Korea. I think that by now aid agencies have so thoroughly penetrated North Korea, they are able to go into 70% of provinces in North Korea, that they are fairly well aware of food situation. They're very knowledgeable, and so in that sense, that I don't think the kind of catastrophe that happened in 1995 will repeat itself. Mm. However, there is tremendous food shortage today in North Korea. The public distribution system, which got somewhat revived, does not give enough food for people. It can only ration something like only half of minimum daily needs for barely 40% of, you know, some urban population. And so, you know, the system isn't really working very much. And, you know, if the world goes ahead with economic sanctions by taking North Korea to the Security Council, and somehow embargo works, which means denial of oil and other stuff, food stuff to North Korea, I think that that will probably deepen the misery of the people there. I mean, although I think that in the United Nations Security Council, there will be a veto by the Chinese if the bill is brought forth to the Security Council.
We'll take a couple more, I think, and then we should go. Yeah, one here, and then I'll take you. Thank you. George.
Hi, my name is Jun Cho. I'm an undergraduate student here. First of all, thank you for the great lecture. I wanted to ask you about the last part in your lecture about this transition in the North Korean regime and this transit economy, and how prices are now set by the market. And from this, I understand that we can get hope in that along with these measures in North Korea forced by the famine and more conciliatory measures by the rest of the world, that we can hope that the situation would get better in North Korea. Personally, I am a believer in, for example, Kim Dae-jung's sunshine policy. It's just that the fundamental regime in North Korea of communism is, I think, difficult to break down, even with these slow, irreversible transitions. And I was wondering about your views on this.
You know, there's something I didn't get into because we didn't have time. From the perspective of welfare of people, it's not at all clear at this point that this so-called transition is a good thing. And what I mean by that is that now, because the price is set in the market, the famine that started out as a very non-Amartya Senian kind of socialist famine has turned into a regular famine where people who don't have the money to buy food now starves. Now you have an entitlement crisis. Now you have food that only some people, privileged people, can buy. As country becomes more differentiated, now you have class system developing in that country. So people with money can buy food. Great majority of people who cannot buy food now have to go without food, with the public distribution system not taking care of its people the way they used to be able to before the 1990s. And so when I said that for better or worse, it is a transition society, there is the better part, which is that it might be moving closer, becoming more open, and there is the worst part in the short run. People are much worse off in some sense than they used to be.
Take the last question. If you could hand it back there to the man in the red tie-ish.
Hello, my name's James. I'm actually a student at the School of Oriental and African Studies. Firstly, Professor, thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I wanted to add a comment and a question. I visited North Korea in April last year, and it was my observation that the soil was completely barren. It looked blowtorched. It was, we were told it wasn't the growing season. When we crossed into China, the whole of China, not very far away, was very green with new growth. And my question is that you touched briefly that aid agencies have penetrated 70% of North Korea. I read recently that there were 8 provinces where aid agencies, the World Food Program, were not permitted to enter. Do you have any thoughts as to why it is that these areas, is perhaps the famine too embarrassing? Are there military or political prison camps? Do you have any thoughts why it is these areas of the country are out of bounds? And thank you.
Probably political, but it's very difficult to divine the North Korean rationality in thinking about this stuff. I mean, there are clearly some areas with camps, prisoner camps maybe, and military installations, but not always. So I really can't tell you. As the six-party talks came to a grinding halt, there was the inter-Korean ministerial talk last week, and in part, in order to break the stalemate, the South Korean government pledged that it will go ahead giving fertilizer to North Koreans, and so they will deliver 200 million. That sounds like a lot. Do I have the figure right? Tons of fertilizer to North Korea. And the problem of that country's soil being devastated, as somebody said, that country has no topsoil. You have to bring huge load of topsoil from someplace to revive the agriculture there. So I'm glad that you mentioned the ecological degradation in that country.
Thank you. I know there are one or two other people with questions, but we run over our normal closing time, and you are all, courtesy of the generosity of Standard Chartered, invited to a drink upstairs on the fifth floor in the senior common room, and there you can buttonhole Professor Wu Cummings with your remaining questions. It remains for me to thank you for a fascinating lecture, and to say also that one of the aims of the Gillam Chair and the lecture series has been to broaden the school's interests in Asian studies. We have a lot of people who work on Asian studies, but we want to broaden that further, and I can certainly say that this first lecture has done that absolutely admirably, because I can't recall, certainly in the couple of years I've been here, a talk centered on North Korea and particularly on the famine, which has also ranged so broadly into the geopolitical implications and what Western countries should do about it. So for me, this was absolutely fascinating. I can tell from the audience reaction that it was for them too. We're most grateful to you for coming.
Thank you very much.